I had the opportunity to get my real estate license, where I learned, as you know, that everything in the real estate market is location, location, location. Well, we generally meet for these conferences, and we get together and we debate and argue a lot about New Testament scriptures, especially the difficult ones that tend to cause people to think that there is polytheism in the New Testament. And we do well by doing that because we need to be ready. We need to be prepared for when you talk to somebody and they trot out their favorite verse and you say, okay, well, now let's deal with that. That's not what I'm going to do today. What I want to do is go back a little bit before that and talk about context, context, context. Before you get to the New Testament and start arguing about this verse and that verse and get into Philippians 2 and spend 2 days there, what is the context in which it was written? What is the context in which the hearers heard it, in which the writer wrote it? If we have that established, I think that we can then go on to have a more meaningful discussion of those New Testament passages. And we can continue doing what we were doing, realizing the context behind it all. The Bible is the story of a portion of the Hebrew people. Now think about that. The Bible is often thought about as this universal book for all people at all times, but if you read it carefully, it starts out fairly broad, and it narrows, and it narrows, and it narrows, and it goes down to a man named Eber, from which we get the word Hebrew, and down to someone called Shem, and then down to Abraham, which was the great, 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 great grandson of Eber. I counted. Abraham was a Hebrew. He was one of the people about which the Bible was written. And Abraham lived in Ur of the Chaldees, we also know that area as Babylon, in a culture based on polytheism. Go back and study Babylon, and you'll see the roots of much of the polytheism that's here with us today. The one true creator God called Abraham out of that land, out of the land, out of the culture, out of the religion, and Abraham became something totally foreign to the culture in which he had emerged from, strictly monotheistic. He worshipped one God, which was very different from where he'd come from. We don't know a lot about Abraham when he was in Ur, or when this occurred to him, or how this got to him. Did he grow up that way? We're not sure, but when he left polytheism, and he was walking around with the idea of monotheism, a very different thing from his peers. And he passed this on to his descendants, to his son, Isaac, and his son's son, Jacob, and his descendants. And this teaching that he took with him when he was asked to leave the land of Ur, the land of Babylon, this monotheism, or as Anthony has pointed out, unitary monotheism, one God in one person, is the teaching that Abraham took with him out of Babylon and passed on to his children. It became the core of the religion of the Israel people. Now, as a little excursus here, before we get into a discussion or an argument or a debate or however you'd like to phrase it with someone, you want to really establish what you're trying to do, and ideally, the other person would establish with you what they're trying to do, because there's two things that you could choose from. Are you here to defend a position, or are you here to seek the truth? There's only two things you can do. If you're here to defend a position, you will fortify, you will dig in, and you will not move. And it doesn't really matter what the other person says. They might have great arguments, but you aren't moving. If you're here to seek the truth, you may have a position, but you're not dedicated to fortifying it or even occupying it. You're willing to leave that position if the facts show that you really ought to occupy another position. It's one or the other. They're mutually exclusive. And it would do well. I'm going to personally practice this from now on. And we would do well to do this. Sit down with the person you're talking with and say, hey, could we identify who we are? Are we defending positions or seeking truth? And if you're a position defender, well, you know what? Brother, I love you, and I have other things to do. Because nothing I can say will sway you from your position. So let's not waste our time. Let's go do some other things that are more worthwhile. There's all kinds of good things to do. How can you find out if a person is in this setup? Ask them a simple question. What could I say to you that would cause you to abandon your current position? Is there anything I could say, any evidence I could present, that would cause you to move to another position? I recently had a discussion with someone in which he said, no, absolutely not. I've had an experience that has caused me to hold a position, and nothing you can say, nothing you can argue, could cause me to move from that. I smiled and said, well, it's good to talk to you, brother. And we saved a lot of time and a lot of wrangling, because we're just going to beat up on each other after that. So are we ready to defend a position, or are we ready to move, if need be, and not easily? Don't move easily. Make them work to move you, but be willing to move if the evidence so dictates. Abraham had a position to defend. He was a man, perhaps of some means. We know at least that he had a home, he had his family, he had his culture, he had everything where he was. And his God called him out of that and said, I want you to leave all this. Abraham could have easily taken a position and dug in and fortified. He didn't. He was known as a man of faith who moved when he needed to move, literally and figuratively. And rather than staying there, he followed the call of his God, even when it meant certainly being a wanderer and experiencing uncertainty and discomfort. And that's what I would wish for you and for me, that we would experience some uncertainty and discomfort as we go through life. Because if you're too comfortable, you've fortified your position, and you're not going anywhere. Abraham, though, decided to do that, to take the call and literally move. Now, prior to receiving the Torah from the Creator, by the hands of Moses, the Israelites, Abraham's descendants, they had no codified law that we know of, written down as the Torah was and on the stone tablets. But they had the teaching from Abraham that comprised the core of their religion, of their teaching, and that was they worshipped the one Creator God. They were fiercely monotheistic, and history will bear this out. I'm going back far back into time, well before the intertestament time and the times when things started to get murky, going way back toward the time of Moses and before. I think it's easy to establish how strictly Unitarian monotheistic these people were from their beliefs and from contrasting them with the nations that surrounded them, which were, by and large, perhaps we could say, all polytheistic. I appreciate Richard's talk about all this morning. I'm going to have to pause every time I say that word now. Think, do I really mean all? And how wrong am I when I say it? In order to understand the New Testament, we must realize that the faith of our Messiah and his disciples was rooted entirely in its Hebrew roots. They were Hebrews writing about the faith of the Hebrew people of Israel. They had the creeds of Israel, they had the laws of Israel, and they worshipped the Creator, the God of Israel. This was the context in which they lived. And we can only understand the identity of the God they worshipped by encompassing the context of the Hebrew Scriptures, which is where they learned. The New Testament didn't exist at that time in the first century. So the Scriptures that they had in front of them was their context. And there may have been many other books and papers and things that were circulating, but the Orthodox is probably not the right word, the faithful Israelites who followed the Torah, followed the Torah. They didn't follow all these other books and weird things and all these other writings and ideas that were flowing around. They had the Torah in their hand, and those that were faithful to it followed that. And I think that's where we have to look for our context in which the New Testament books were written. The Old Testament identifies the identity of our God. The God that these New Testament writers wrote about. They got their context from the Old Testament. It identifies his title, his name, his number, his exclusivity, and his relationship to us. All the things we argue about in all the New Testament verses where we say, well, is it this or is it that? All of those things that we're arguing about are identified in the Old Testament writings and establish the context in which the New Testament writings were written. Then Old Testament also has the commands of our God. Now that we have identified him, what does he expect of us? And finally, it also has the penalty for following other gods. Once we establish these seven things, we can understand the context of the Old Testament, and we can jump right into the New Testament, and it will start making sense what was going on. Well, the title of our God, let's start with that. Point number one. Our God differs from every other God. Oh, by the way, I have to take this opportunity at the One God Conference to make the following statement. There are many gods. Don't think that the folks here at the One God Conference have their heads in the sand and we don't get it. There are many gods. Where do I get such a crazy statement? Well, from the one who gave the first commandment that said, thou shalt have no other gods before me. You have to be able to both obey and disobey that commandment for that commandment to make any sense. There are many gods. Well, how is our God, the God of the Hebrew faith, to distinguish himself from the many gods if we were to do that? And the answer is that among all the many gods, which are really not any god, but we treat them as such, and if you treat something as a god, voila, it becomes. Among those gods, or so-called gods of the many nations of polytheism, our Creator God, our God, has the distinction of being something that they do not have, and that is the Creator of all that is. And so we have, to begin with, the title of our God, Creator. And that is unique among the gods. We have all kinds of scriptures on this. I'll just read a few. Genesis 2:4. These are the generations of the heavens of the earth when they are created in the day that Yehovah God made them, the earth and the heavens. This is from the books that the faithful Israelites would have used as their creed, their context. They understood that their God was the Creator. And Nehemiah 9:6, thou, even thou, art the Lord alone. Thou hast made heaven and the heaven of heavens with all their host, the earth and all things that are in, the sea and all that is therein. Again and again, there's references to their God being the Creator. When we read in Acts 4, the response that the people had, the disciples had, when Peter and John came back, we read in Acts 4:24, when they heard that, they lifted up their voice to God with one accord and said, thou, Lord, thou art God, which made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is. This was not some strange revelation. This was Israelites stating the creed of Israel, which was obvious to all of them. They learned it from their youth, and they said, our God is the Creator God. They were just stating his title as a matter of glory, glory to him. The second point of context from the Old Testament is the name of the Creator God. All the gods of the nations had names. You have Chemosh and Dagon, and all they all have names. And for some reason, the name of the Hebrew God gets lost when you read the Bible because it's been obscured, replaced, substituted, and it disappeared. You could pick up the King James Bible and say, well, I don't see a name anywhere, but it's there. Go back to the original language, and it's there. And not only that, but it's important. And I'm going over it now, not because I'm a holy namer, but because it is a key to identifying the identity of the God of the Hebrew faith. It's important from that perspective. In fact, it was so important that when Moses was talking with his God, about the first question out of his mouth was, well, when they ask me, because he knew they would, what shall I tell them is your name? What is his name, he says. What shall I say unto them? Exodus 3:13. It's the key name scripture. Moses is saying, I'm going to go to the Israelites, and I'm going to try to identify you because I totally believe in you. I'm a faithful man, but what do I say? Who are you? How do I show them who I talk to? And he got an answer. The next verse. By the way, context, just keep reading. If you got a problem, just keep reading. Finish that sentence, finish that paragraph, finish that chapter, finish the book, and then you'll start to have context. Just keep reading in verse 14. And God said unto Moses, I am that I am. And he said, thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me unto you. Well, there you go. Moses got his answer. His name is I am. Only problem is, you don't find him called I am ever again in the Old Testament. So that would seem to be a problem if that's his name. and he never uses it again. Well, solution to the problem. Keep reading. Don't stop there. Verse 15. And God said moreover unto Moses, this is just continuing. I stopped in the middle here, but the Creator didn't. He just kept going. Thou shalt say unto the children of Israel, what does it say in your English Bible? The Lord. And it's all capitalized. That's YHWH. Yehovah, Yahweh, Jehovah, however you choose to pronounce it. Pronounce it the best you can and be open to a better idea. But the fact is, there's a name there that's been obscured by your translation. He says, Yehovah, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me unto you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial unto all generations. He identified himself to Moses by name. It was such a good question that he answered it directly. Incidentally, you do see the name YHWH, Yehovah, Yahweh, many, many times after that, thousands of times. It's so important it's used again and again and again. And in fact, the third commandment is even all about it and how to not take it in vain or bring it to nothingness, which of course has been done. The third commandment, I would argue, could be the most disobeyed commandment of the ten. It's another story. You can ask me about that if you're interested. Point number three of the context is the number. Ah, now we get down to it, the number of the Creator God. How many is he? Zero, one, two, three, many. And we have people to believe all of those things, of course. He identified to the Israelites who he was. And that's critical because that became the core of their faith. We all know the passage in Deuteronomy 4. Hear, O Israel, Yehovah our God, Yehovah is one. You shall love Yehovah thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, with all thy might. This became the core of the Israelite religion. Notice I don't say the Jewish religion because Judaism and the religion of Israel are two different things. Judaism has the Talmud. The religion of Israel, the Hebrew faith, has the Torah. Never the twain shall meet. So I'm not talking about Judaism, neither in the time of Moses, nor in the time of the Intertestament, or the time of now. It's a different religion from the Hebrew faith, the religion of Israel. But to the Hebrews, to the Israelites, the Creator God gave his commandments, and he spoke them first, and then he wrote them down, so they could hear it, and they could see it. And the first commandment, and God spoke all these words, saying, I am Yehovah thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And as Anthony has mentioned, I go into some detail. I've got a paper on the back that you can take. Looks like this. And you're welcome to do this, and you can go and look into it in some detail. I have gone through and mentioned some of the arguments regarding the number and the pronouns. And I went into some detail about the pronouns I and me and you and us and that sort of thing. And just to make it short work of that, if you appeal to grammar to establish the number of God in Scripture in the Old Testament, then let us appeal to grammar. And do you take the six places where there are plural pronouns? Or do you take the thousands? Anthony says there's 15,000. I have no reason to dispute him and no inclination to count. Do you take the thousands and thousands of singular pronouns and go with those? If you do take the six, if you use the argument, which you shouldn't, if you do use the argument that it says, let us make man in our image, read the next verse where it says me and my and I. And in every place where there is an argument for plurality in the pronouns, in the very next verse, there is an argument for singularity. I believe Brian Fulton mentioned this, that a rabbi has noticed this. I didn't know about the rabbi, but I noticed it myself, and I'd have to agree with him on that. But the point is, every time the context of the supposedly polytheistic, that is, they are plural pronouns, every time it supposedly means more than one God, in the very next verse it's singular. So how do you reconcile that? What you do is you go with the evidence. And the evidence is overwhelmingly in favor of the singular. But if you don't want to go with the evidence, if you have dug yourself in and you're stuck there, I recommend the following thing. Be consistent and agree with yourself. If you want to use the plural pronouns to show more than one God, be consistent and say gods, say lords, say us, say we, say things like this throughout the entire Bible. And when you read, don't say God, say gods. Be consistent, because you have appealed to grammar shall you go. I would hope that one would be consistent and consistently wrong, or just abandon the whole plural pronoun issue. We just put a stake in the heart of that one and move on, because there's more interesting stuff. I didn't even go through that just now. I just kind of gave you my results, but it's there to go through. Number four, the exclusivity of the one creator God. He calls himself a jealous God, and he is absolutely determined that the Israelites are not going to worship any other God, which, by the way, tells you that there are other gods to worship. The exclusivity of the creator God was unquestioned in the Old Testament. Moses witnessed, he witnessed all kinds of things. I mean, where do you start? Deuteronomy 4:35, unto thee it was showed that thou mightest know that Yehovah, he is God, there is none else beside him. You don't have to turn to Isaiah and argue away the Isaiah scriptures, which are legion, by saying, oh, that's referring to those other things, idols and stuff. This is Moses. If you can't trust Moses, who can you trust? Solomon, that all the people of the earth may know that Yehovah is God and that there's none else. Solomon wanted everyone to know it. And actually, he was in a position to make that happen. I wonder how well he did before he got off track. Hezekiah witnessed, O Yehovah of hosts, God of Israel, that dwells between the cherubims, thou art God, even thou alone, in Isaiah 37. There's manifold witnesses about the exclusivity of the worship of the one creator God. This is the core of the Hebrew faith. Even Yehovah himself witnessed in Isaiah 45, and does this not say at all? I am Yehovah, there is none else, there is no God beside me, I girded thee, though thou hast not known me, that thou may know from the rising of the sun from the west that there is none beside thee. I am Yehovah, and there is none else. I think he made the point rather well. And I think, well, one more verse, Isaiah 45:18. For thus saith Yehovah that created the heavens, God himself that formed the earth and made it. He has established it, he has not created it in vain. He formed it to be inhabited. I am Yehovah, and there is none else. And he did this again and again and again. There's lots more verses of this. He was emphatic about the declaration that there is only one, and he was emphatic that he be the only one that was worshipped. And indeed, the sin that got Israel in trouble again and again and again was idolatry. When they went away from the first commandment, he took action, and he brought them back. Notice these verses also, especially the ones where Yehovah himself is speaking. They're all singular. Me, my, I. Every time. Something that hasn't gotten a lot of play, and I think we need to talk this up. Talk this up to your friends, especially the ones that are telling you that, well, you know, God the Father wasn't really talked about or revealed until the New Testament when his Son revealed him. And you know what? In the New Testament, his Son did reveal him. But guess what? He was already revealed in so many ways. And I appreciated Richard Fix's description of Revelation as 285 verses referring to the Old Testament, plus a few more that were new. If you want to understand the New Testament, you go and study the Old Testament. It will provide a foundation, a context in which you can understand the whole thing. In the Old Testament, guess who is called our Father? Well, we've already established his title is Creator, his name is Yehovah, and he is called our Father in the Old Testament a number of times, more than you might expect. Isaiah says it twice, once in Isaiah 63, once in Isaiah 64, doubtless thou art our Father, though Abraham be ignorant of us, and Israel acknowledge us not, thou art, O Yehovah, art our Father. Now you see why it was critical, at least for the presentation I'm making at this moment, to go into what is his name. Because Isaiah identifies that our Father is named Yehovah, or Yahweh if you prefer. I'm not a stickler for pronunciation, I'm just doing the best I can. In fact, I didn't really even get the urge to pronounce his name in any way until I realized that my children, I was going to be reading to them from the Bible, and I had to say something. And I knew the Lord wasn't right, so I had to start digging. You know what? I may have come up with the wrong answer, and if I did, you'll show me and I'll move. But you have to do something. Take a stand. Isaiah 64. But now, O Yehovah, thou art our Father. We are the clay, you are the potter, we're the work of thy hand. He's the Creator who made us, and he's our Father. Isaiah knew this. It identifies the God of Israel, the central figure of the Hebrew faith. David, well, it's Moses also. He knew the Creator, Yehovah. And this is a scripture you might not see too often in this context. Deuteronomy 32, verse 6. Do you thus requite Yehovah, O foolish people and unwise? Is he not the Father that have brought thee? Hath he not made thee and established thee? Moses was telling the people, your Creator is also your Father. David recognized this too. Psalm 89, thou art my Father, my God. And he starts that verse in verse 18 with, for Yehovah is our defense. He equated Yehovah equals Father, his Creator. All over the Old Testament, these equations weave through all of the work until the context is so established that it's inescapable. In Malachi, have we not all one Father? Has not God created us? Again in Malachi 1, if I be a father, where is mine honor? And if I be a master, where is my fear? Says Yehovah. Once again, we've got the name of God linked with his title, Father. And often it's also linked with his other title, Creator. So when we understand his name, we can also understand his role and his title. Another little excursus. Was the Messiah God-made man, or man-made God? It's an interesting question. We had already talked today about Daniel 7, where he is brought before the throne. It goes like this. I saw in the night visions, and behold, the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days. And they brought him near before him, and there was given him a dominion, a glory, and a kingdom. That all people, nations, and languages shall serve him, and it goes on. And in Matthew 26, our Messiah, Yehoshua, he identified himself as that Son of Man. So he knew about Daniel 7. So the question, if he was brought before the Ancient of Days and given this kingdom, and yet he supposedly was God in the polytheistic two-God or three-God model, consider this. How can someone be God when he is brought before God to be given a kingdom by God? Did you catch all those? Pronouns. Prepositions, excuse me. I love the prepositions. We homeschool our children, and trying to teach them all the right prepositions is a real bugaboo. And if you've ever learned a foreign language, prepositions, that's your downfall. You may be good at everything else. You're going down on the prepositions. Watch out for those. Does it make any sense for God to bring himself before himself and give a kingdom to himself? Read Daniel 7 again with that in mind. Try to identify the characters by name, because if you don't name them, you will call this one the Lord, you'll call that one the Lord. Yeah, there's some capital letters in one and not in the other, but you know what? You can substitute Lord for Lord, and yeah, nobody's the wiser. Name them by name, and everything will come out clear, and you'll say, oh, I just had a contradiction. I just had somebody giving himself his own kingdom. Or, if you name them correctly by name, you'll understand. You'll understand exactly what's going on. The sixth point of context in the Old Testament is the commands to worship only the one Creator God. He's jealous, and he says, I want you only to worship me. Deuteronomy 6, thou shalt fear Yehovah thy God and serve him, and shall swear by his name. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the people who are round about you. Notice, further acknowledgement, there are other gods. Don't go there. For Yehovah thy God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of Yehovah be kindled against you and destroy thee from off the face of the earth. And it shall be, if you do all forget Yehovah thy God, Deuteronomy 18, and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify you against this day that you shall surely perish. That's exactly what happened. He will not tolerate idolatry. He will not tolerate polytheism. And be not deceived. If you have more than one God, you are a polytheist. It is the definition of polytheism, more than one. And so many people try to dance around it and evade the charge of polytheism. Be honest. Say gods and lords and say, I'm a polytheist. I respect you for that. We differ, but I respect the person that is consistent and honest. And you know what? If you're consistent and honest and wrong, and you're seeking and you're willing to move, in time, you will be consistent and honest and right. We will end up in unity over time if we all pursue the truth, because we'll all end up at the same place. And that's the only kind of unity that makes any sense, and it's the only kind of unity that's worth anything, is that the reason we're unified is because we all arrived at the same place. That will keep us unified. Finally, in the context of the Old Testament, there is the penalty for worshiping other than the one Creator God. This is a big deal. And don't you think the Israelites would have missed the significance of this? In Deuteronomy 13, I'm going to read this through this, I want you to put yourself in the position of being an Israelite, listening to old man Moses, who spoke the whole book of Deuteronomy in one day, I believe. Check it out. And listening to old man Moses, who loved his people, and you're one of his people standing there listening to him. Okay? Put yourself in that context. How did this sound? If there arise among you a prophet, this is Deuteronomy 13, the first few verses, or a dreamer of dreams, and giveth thee a sign or a wonder, and the sign or wonder come to pass. Hey, he did it. He called it before it happened. Whereof he spake unto thee, saying, let us go after other gods, which thou hast not known, and let us serve them. Now consider, the Israelites had just been told, Deuteronomy 6, God is one. They know his name, they know his title, they know his function, Father. They know that he's jealous, and they've just seen the polytheism of Egypt repudiated by the unitary monotheism, one God in one person, of their God. They've just seen this. When it says, go after other gods which thou hast not known, substitute in the various philosophies and various teachings that you hear around you today. God is one, but in three persons. Or the Seventh-day Adventist tritheism, there are three gods, but it's kind of one in some way. Or two gods, or two-in-one binity, or you know all the various things. If they had been thinking any of these things, would the Israelites who were thinking these things have failed this test? Or would they have passed? Think about what was in their head when Moses said, going and serving after other gods. I don't think the modern theories that we're immersed in were running around at that time. Maybe at the intertestamental time, perhaps, but not at the time when Moses was talking. Thou shalt not hearken to the words of that prophet. And then go down a little bit, and that prophet or dreamer of dreams shall be put to death. If you're a polytheist, we kill you. Thus saith Moses. That's what it says. And that's exactly how they would have read it at that time in that context. They would not have said, well, you know, we know that there's one God, but there's kind of three built into that. It wouldn't have washed. Not in that context. Maybe later, but not then. The God of Israel was known to be one in number. If you preached that he was plural or divisible or something other than one, the penalty was death. Deuteronomy 17. If there be found among you, within the gates which Jehovah thy God giveth thee, a man or a woman that has wrought wickedness in the sight of Jehovah thy God, in transgressing his covenant, has gone and served other gods and worshipped them, and then later on, thou shalt bring forth that man or woman, thou shalt stone him with stones, that he die. Now we have the mouth of two witnesses, or at least Moses witnessing twice. It was that important that he mentioned it twice. Polytheism equals death. And finally, in Deuteronomy 18, 19, and 20, read those chapters, and you will also see, if thou shalt speak in the name of other gods, even that prophet shall die. Three times, Moses went out of his way to establish that Israel was so strictly monotheistic that if you preached other gods, you're going to die with rocks thrown at you. That's the context of the Mosaic Torah in which our Hebrew faith is based. Now, the New Testament context, having gone through those 7 points of Old Testament context, we now see where the New Testament writers came from. Who they were Israelites, they were Hebrews, and when they wrote to their people, their fellow people. Remember what Paul said? I'm a Hebrew of the Hebrews, I'm a Benjamite, he's writing to his people Israel. They knew who they were, they knew what their context was, and when they quoted the scriptures, there was no New Testament, they were quoting the Hebrew scriptures of which we have just seen the context. Consider what the New Testament would be like without the direct quotes from the Old Testament. I told you we homeschooled. I did something really, really awful. I mean, there's some people that could get really upset with this. I had my son participate, and I thank you to Eric for helping me with this. Had my son participate in helping me to, well, censor the Bible. And so I showed him what to do, and he said, Daddy, what are you doing? He's seen me underline things before, but he's never seen this before. He said, Daddy, what are you doing? He was horrified. And I said, well, I'm taking all the direct quotes from the Old Testament, and I'm just blacking them out so that you can't see them anymore in the New Testament. These are just the direct quotes, not the references. If you wiped out the references, this would be a black page. But, you know, as you go through, just kind of randomly churning through the New Testament, just pick a page. Let's see, the book of Romans. I love the book of Romans. Look at it go. My son's been scribbling in my Bible, and I love it. This is what happens when you remove the direct quotes of the Old Testament from the New Testament. You end up with something that looks like it's been censored by the old Soviet Empire. The New Testament, without the direct quotes of the Old Testament, is a shell. It's hollow. It's meaningless. And if you take out the references to the Old Testament, there is no New Testament. It's entirely gone because nothing makes sense. They refer to things constantly that are the context of the Bible, our Hebrew faith. Did the Creator deceive Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Moses, David, Isaiah, and Daniel into thinking that he was one God in one person, witness the singular pronouns, when he was really in some way two or perhaps three? Was this a later revelation that they just didn't get it until the time of 300 or 400 AD when we really started to get it? Are we willing to say that he kept them in the dark about who he was when he revealed so much about himself? He did everything but keep them in the dark. He told them all about himself. Are we really ready to say that this later revelation is the real deal? Now, in the current condition in which we find ourselves, it's really no big deal if someone's running around saying, you know, hey, God is in the trees, or there's three gods in one, or there's three gods in the SDA view and all this stuff. Everybody has their own thought. We're tolerant. We have religious freedom in this country. It's no big deal when your neighbor says that. In Israel, it was a big deal. You run around saying things like that, we're going to put you to death. We're going to pick up stones, and it's all over. Because it violates the first commandment and the basis of monotheism. So, was there any sort of environment of tolerance in the first century when the New Testament writers were writing? Now we're ready to embark on what was the environment, the context in which they wrote. Well, consider this. Before we get into other things, the temple still stood. Right? In all of the books that were written except perhaps John and Revelation, I think all the other books were written prior to 70 AD, New Testament, the temple still stood. The Levitical priesthood still functioned. The people still obeyed the laws of the Torah. Remember Yehoshua's parents, our Messiah, when he was born, what did they do? They went and had him circumcised, and they went according all to the law of Moses, the laws of purification, every last law in the Torah, they fulfilled it because they were, the parents of our Messiah, were faithful Hebrew, Israelite, Torah-observant people. And they knew what their context was, they knew who their God was, and they knew what he expected of them, and they obeyed. That's where they were. The scribes and Pharisees, they wanted to find occasion against Yehoshua the Messiah. What'd they have to do? Suborn false witnesses. Because, like Daniel before him, he was doing everything right, and they couldn't call him on breaking any of the laws. So they had to get liars to come and get him. And then Paul, Peter, Stephen, Timothy, and many more lived according to the Torah and quoted from it extensively, as you've seen in my censored version of the New Testament. This was the environment in which the New Testament was written. This was the environment in which the writers believed. This was the environment in which the hearers or readers would have understood it. Consider some New Testament witnesses. Let's start with Matthew. Then saith Yehoshua unto them, Get thee hence, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship Yehovah thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. Quoting directly from Deuteronomy 6. You won't find any even remote support for polytheism in Matthew, but you will find quite a bit of support for following the one God of the Hebrew faith. A witness of Mark, and I recommend this if you haven't looked at it carefully, Mark 12, when the scribe came up to Yehoshua and repeated the Shema, Deuteronomy 6, and Yehoshua said, that's right. He agreed with it completely, and he said, you're not far from the kingdom of heaven. Go back and read that. He is affirming the faith, the Hebrew faith of his people, and the scribe, this particular scribe, got it right. How about the witness of Peter? I have much to say about Peter. I love Peter's sermons. The whole book of Acts is just my favorite, and I'm passionate about this, and sometimes I beat people over the head with it because I'm so excited. And to those of you who I've done that to, I'm sorry, but I'm going to keep doing it. Okay, so I'm not so very sorry, I guess. But I'm not going to go too far into Acts out of consideration for Gary Falcuri, who has an excellent presentation coming up tomorrow on the book of Acts. And I'll mention a little bit something here, but you should listen to him. He knows what he's talking about, and it's going to be really good. The stuff from Peter and others in the book of Acts is very, very compelling. If you want to start in the book of Acts talking about the nature of God, you will do very well. Let me just mention, out of all of those, my particular favorite, Acts 4. Acts 4, 24 through 27. Just go over this. Gary may touch on this again, but you know what? It's worth hearing again. It's that good. And when they had heard that, they lifted up their voice with one accord and said, Lord, thou art God, which made heaven and earth, the earth and sea, that all that in them is. Down a few verses. Against thy holy child, Yehoshua. Well, there you have it. This is almost like an equation, like an equal sign. And I love math. I was an engineer by my training, and math was just something that came easy to me, and I love it. There's an equation here. If you like math, you better dig into Acts 4. It says, it identifies the Creator and the God of our fathers, and it says that he has a child, and his name is Yehoshua, Jesus. And so there you have it. We understand the identity of the Creator, the God of the Old Testament, the God of Israel, and it tells you who his son is. Go through the book of Acts, and I look forward to Gary's presentation. Peter preached that it was the Creator who raised his son from the dead. And the one who raised the man, Yehoshua, from the dead was the Creator, the God of our fathers, and incidentally, distinct from the man, Yehoshua. So we have all kinds of clues, if we have eyes to see and ears to hear, of the Hebrew context in which this was written and which the people heard it. There's much more in Acts, and I'm going to move on because you'll hear more of it. I know my father will be here presenting as well, and he's got some things to say about this too. So it's kind of a trifecta. Three of us this time, instead of going through the difficult scriptures, we decided to go with the powerful witnesses for unitary monotheism without knowing that we were each doing this thing. And just recently I realized that what we were doing, so you'll hear a whole lot of powerful witnesses from the Bible promoting unitary monotheism, and they all dovetail and they all work. If you read through Peter's messages, you will see that he agrees with Moses, and that the Creator God condemns polytheism, the worship of more than one God, however you want to slice it. And people slice it all kinds of different ways. The witness of James, the Hebrew. Notice who these people were. This was James the Hebrew. What was his background? Could it be Hebrew? Like all the other apostles, he believed in one God. We only have one verse that's really interesting. James 2, thou believest there is one God, thou doest well. The devils also believe and tremble. This knowledge is not done in a corner. It's not some knowledge that no one knows. Even the demons knew it, and they were worried about it. This is the great central core truth of the faith of Israel. How about the witness of Paul, the Hebrew, a Hebrew of the Hebrews? In Acts 13, read Acts 13. It's astounding what Paul is saying. He identifies the God of this people, Israel, as the one who raised up his son, Yehoshua, raised him from the dead. And then it says, through this man is preached unto you forgiveness of sins. Who's the man? His son, Yehoshua. He's identified as a man, not as a God, or someone even who was God. It just says, through this man. Acts 17, once again, starting in verse 24, God that made the world and all things therein, and then there's much more text, and at the end it says, in verse 30, 31, he has appointed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained. Who is Yehoshua the Messiah? He is the man whom his father Yehoah ordained or chose to be in that office, to do what he did. He was that chosen man. And notice that he is separate and distinct from his father. We already talked about 1 Corinthians 8:6, which is a marvelous verse. There is one God, the Father, and one Lord, Yehoshua the Christ. Clear speech. We've also already talked about 1 Timothy 2:5. For there is one God and one mediator between God and men, the man, Christ, Yehoshua. If you draw yourself a picture, we have the one God over here, we have men over here, and what is a mediator? Someone who is between them, who's in the middle between them. When you are a mediator, it means that you are in between the two parties, trying to reconcile them, which means that you are neither of those parties. Now, Yehoshua was a man, but he was exalted to the right hand and sat down on the throne that was prepared for him. That's why there are thrones in Daniel, because it was prepared for him when he was exalted to sit on that throne. What is his status at this moment? He's our mediator. And, well, what's his status? Is he man? Well, no, because he's been given eternal life. Is he God? Well, you might argue that point. He's certainly not the creator God. A mediator is one who stands in between and is not a party to either side. How else can we have a mediator unless there's somebody who is able to represent both sides by being neither side? And of course, Hebrews 1, I love this verse. I'm going to try to say this. Every time someone will let me speak about anything, I'm going to try to say talk about Hebrews 1, 1 and 2. God, who at sundry times and in diverse manners spake in times past unto the fathers. Stop. Who was the God of Israel that spoke unto the fathers? He was the Creator. He was Yehoah. He was the one God, the God of Israel. We know who this is. The context of the Old Testament demands that we know who this is. And the people that heard this, I think Paul wrote the book of Hebrews. We could argue that. The people that heard Paul, when if he spoke it, or if they read it after he wrote it, they would have understood exactly what he was talking about because the context was clear. By the prophets has in these last days spoken to us by his son. Crystal clear. We know who was speaking. We know that he's speaking now through his son. And Hebrews 1, 1 and 2 is marvelous. we can finish the rest too, lest you think I'm not repeating the rest of it for some other agenda, whom he has appointed heir of all things, by, through, on account of, or however that preposition works itself out. Help us out, let's study that, let's dig into it, by whom he also made the worlds. Whatever worlds is, and whatever by means. But we know that it's not because of the context. We know that the writer of Hebrews, Paul if it was, did not just kind of suddenly slip in, oh, by the way, this Messiah I'm preaching to you, he's the creator. You know what? They wouldn't have accepted it. It violates the context in which he grew up, in which the hearers were hearing. Because in Hebrews 10, we see further, he says, this man, after he has offered one sacrifice for sins forever, sat down on the right hand of God. Clear speech. A man who was exalted and sat on the throne. He was enthroned because it was meant to be, because he was the man ordained by God. Did Paul reveal a second member of the God family, which was what I was taught growing up? Did Paul or John reveal a triune God? If so, then his Hebrew listeners, and note this, would have been bound by their law to kill him. If they even thought he was talking about polytheism and preaching other gods, the Torah said that they were supposed to be killed. He was supposed to be killed. That is compelling context in which Paul wrote what he wrote. In a similar way, we have John, the witness of John, and he also, John the Hebrew, followed after Matthew, Mark, and Luke and their Gospels. Not a hint of polytheism in any one of those Gospels. If John had followed through with talking about, you know, you heard about God was one, but, you know, he's really more than one. You can go through all of the examples, and I've listed many of these here, where John would have been stoned by his contemporaries. They would have killed him for preaching polytheism. On the back page of the paper I have here, I'm going to point out something to you. If you have it, turn to the back page. In the New Testament, when you see the word God, check this out. It's used a lot of times. Look at the word God in English, and notice that it refers to God the Father. How do we know? Read the context of the verse. Read 10 of them. Read 100 of them. Read 1,000 of them, because there's more than 1,000. You'll find that when it talks about God, almost always, the vast majority of those 11, 1,200, however many there are referring to God the Father. And when our Messiah talks about his God, my God and your God, remember that one? He's talking about his Father and our Father. So try this. I love equations. You'll have to humor me here, because I'm still clinging to all that mathematical training. God equals the Father in the New Testament. If you don't believe that, then go and establish it for yourself. And if you've got a different answer, I want to know it, because I'm ready to move if you want to show me something that will cause me to move. But for the moment, take the proposition that God equals the Father, and then do the simple recipe that follows on this page. Substitute back in the Father into John 1:1 and see what it does for you. Fascinating. You can amaze your friends with this and stupefy them. If they're willing to stipulate that God equals the Father in the New Testament, which I think is a completely grounded statement, if you're willing to stipulate that, the rest falls out for free, and you can just leave your friends shaking their heads, because John 1:1 takes on a whole new meaning. Now, we have a number of things. I'll just read a couple of scriptures from John. For the Father has judged us no man, but has committed all judgment unto the Son. That's fascinating. Why does the Son, at this time, right this moment, sit upon a throne, having all judgment committed unto him? He's been greatly exalted, and here's the key word, delegation. His Father has delegated things to him, and he is in charge of a great deal. People accuse the unitary monotheists of demoting Jesus. Far from it. We recognize his exalted, promoted status. And we recognize how it happened his father gave it to him according to the plan. That's how he got it. As my son gets older, more and more of what I do gets delegated to him. And you know what? As a father, I love that. I love it. Not just because I don't have to do it. Don't get me wrong. But I love that he's growing and maturing, and my daughters and my son, as they are able, I give them more and more responsibility. And then I just delight to see that they're doing the right thing with the power that I've given them. Our Father in heaven delights in giving his son this authority and power. And one day in the kingdom, he will give us positions of some power, and he'll delight in that too. And we'll make him happy by using it correctly. John 5, the Father possesses life in himself. Is there anything that can compare with possessing life within yourself? And he gave the Son to possess life in himself. Now there is an inheritance. There is a gift. The Father gave the Son immortality. Why is he immortal today? Because his Father said so. That was the plan all along. And he wants to give that to us too. And that's a marvelous message. Oh, there's so much more in John. I'm not going to do it because I don't want to take away from the verses that Gary Sherdahl and Gary Falcuri are going to do. And I want you to hear all that as well. But we need to look at perhaps John 12, 49. For I have not spoken of myself, Yehoshua said, but the Father which sent me, he gave me commandment that what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that his commandment is life everlasting. Whatsoever I therefore speak, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. He spoke what his Father told him to speak. He did what his Father told him to do. And he was obedient to his Father in all things because he knew who he was. He was the chosen man, Messiah, the kinsman, redeemer. He knew who his Father was, the Creator God of the Hebrew people of Israel. And he obeyed him, and for that he was glorified and exalted as according to plan. Oh, John 17:3, God the Father is the only true God. Need we be more plain than that? John understood exactly what was going on as a Hebrew speaking to the Hebrews. He very powerfully promoted unitary monotheism. And the places, because as Gary Falcuri mentioned a few years ago, I love this, John is the playground of all heresy. I think he said that 5 years ago, and I love it. If you want to go and argue about the nature of God, you're going to go to the book of John. It's inevitable. Keep in mind that John was a fierce, unitary monotheist of the tradition of the faith of Israel and the Hebrews. That is his context. That's who he is. And when he's speaking, if it looks to you like he's talking about polytheism, preexistence, multiple gods, guess what? You've missed the context. You need to go back and reread your Old Testament because it's there to see and it's powerful. I don't think we really understand the Old Testament very well. I think we spend a lot of time in the New Testament getting muddled. And if we go back to the Old Testament, we're going to understand Revelation because 285 verses from the Old Testament are references. We're going to start understanding the New Testament, which is critical to understand. I look at the Bible as a unit. You've got to have the whole thing. The old without the new is lacking. The new without the old is meaningless. We've got to go back and study our Old Testament so we understand the foundation upon which the apostles and the writers wrote so we can understand what they were saying and what they were not saying and who they were and who they weren't. There wasn't a polytheist among the bunch, and for good reason, because if there had been, their fellows would have killed them. Never forget the death penalty for polytheism. Now, you know what? The Romans occupied Israel. They might not have been able to carry it out by law, but they would have wanted to. And they might have tried to get the Romans to do it for them. I think something like that happened. Did John reveal a second member of the God family? Did he talk about a Trinity? Did he talk about any of these tritheistic, polytheistic things? Absolutely not. We should not be roaming around the New Testament looking for these things. A thorough grounding in the understanding of the Old Testament should not leave us seeking to find polytheism and antinomianism in the New Testament. A thorough grounding in the Old Testament should give us the context in which the writers wrote, the penalty for deviating from that context, and an understanding of both the writers and their audience. Let us go and read through our Old Testament to get the context so that we can understand the New and not get caught up in arguments that aren't grounded in the context of the matter. We have a great tradition of asking questions, and we have some time, I expect. Ken might even, you know, if the questions get real busy here, Ken might even give me another minute or two, because Gary has said that he may not go the whole time. Yes, Brian.
Enjoyed your presentation, thank you. Just wanted to make two comments. you had referred to the Jewish environment of that time, and the faith that they had adhered to and believed in and so forth, and the ideas that were extant at that time, and somewhat made mention of the intertestamental writings as murky and things that not should necessarily be consulted. Just in light of that, I'd like us all to turn to the Old Testament passage where the archangel Michael had argued with Satan over the body of Moses. Does anybody know what I'm talking about? It's mentioned in Jude. How about let's go to the Old Testament passage where the demons were thrown into Tartarus because of their transgressions in the days of Noah? Or how about where Moses argues with Jannes and Jambres that Paul talks about in his epistles? Obviously, I'm being facetious. The passages that I'm referring to are nowhere in the Old Testament, but they are in numerous places in these intertestamental writings. And the only point I'm trying to make is that the New Testament authors were very familiar with many of these writings that were circulated in this time, and in fact, ideas and concepts from them made their way into the New Testament, so they were very familiar with many of these areas. That's just the first comment. The second comment is that the...
Can I deal with that?
Yeah, go ahead.
The writings you're talking about were familiar to them, that's true. But interestingly enough, they at no point formed the core of their religion.
No, I'm not advocating they are.
Other ideas in my current context, but it's not the core of my religion. And it's not to be confused with that. When the Jews, the leaders of the Jews, accused Yehoshua the Messiah, as they did very often, take a good look at those accusations. All of the accusations that they made are false accusations, and we need to be very careful not to latch on to the accusations, the false accusations of the enemies of Yehoshua the Messiah. And I say enemies, I use that word on purpose. He called them all kinds of names. I've got an article where I list all of the foul names he called them. They were his enemies, the leaders of the Jews. He did not try to convert them. He tried to revile them. And the accusations they made were false, and we need to be careful not to latch on to those accusations as if they were true statements. And when they accused him of things, be very careful and say, is this accusation true or false? You'll find out that the leaders of the Jews, the scribes and Pharisees, accused him falsely pretty much all the time.
The second comment I wanted to make is that the explanation of the mediator that you had given between God and man and Messiah being in the midst between the both, being neither man nor God necessarily, I thought that was an excellent explanation. And in fact, that's exactly how these intertestamental Jews viewed this angel of Yahweh, the Old Testament angel of Yahweh, is that he was neither God, nor was he a created being such as angels or men, but that he was actually in the midst between the two, which is why he could be the perfect mediator between the both of them.
The difference being, of course, that the source of this being in question.
Oh, they believe that he was born of God. I mean, we believe the same thing in a different sense, or the Unitarian position, I should say, believes the same thing in a different sense. Nevertheless, everyone in this room would be accused of polytheism by the Pharisees, in that day, because even though you might make the distinction that he rose to the heavens and now sits at the right hand of God and wasn't pre-existent, they would make no distinction whatsoever between that and what these other apocalyptic sects believe. They would say that you also are polytheistic.
We should be pleased to be falsely accused by the Pharisees. We'd be in good company.
Yeah, thank you. I really enjoyed your presentation, and And I really think both your presentation and Brian's is very critical to this whole discussion of putting the focus on context, because nothing has any distinctive meaning without context. So it becomes a matter of identifying the broadest context, which I think you've done, and then how much weight do you put on maybe subcontext, you know, the context between the testaments, you know, that deserves some weight. But you need to look at the context in the broadest sense, the whole Bible. And I think you've done an excellent presentation on context. I really appreciate that. I do have one problem with saying that Jesus was neither God or man. I think he was man. Just because he's a mediator doesn't negate his manhood.
I suppose that depends on timing, right? When we called him that.
I think he started as man. He still is a man. He's exalted, resurrected. He's still 100% man and exalted and resurrected too.
I think we could talk through that, and you may be right about that.
Yeah.
You may be entirely right. To say, is he God now? Okay, now let's define God, and then maybe we can talk about it.
Right, it depends on how you define things. But as far as putting the focus on context, I think you're right on target. Actually, when I speak tomorrow, I'm going to be talking about context too, so I really appreciated your emphasis on context.
I would caution all those here, if you're going to be quoting extensively, especially for support from the Talmud, recognize that the Talmud is the writings of the rabbinical Jews who were the folks that followed after the Pharisees and the scribes. The Talmud, and this is harsh word, and I mean it exactly how I say it, the Talmud is the writings of the enemies of Yehoshua the Messiah. And it is there, the rabbinical Judaism is not the religion of the Torah. It's the religion of the Talmud. And so when you quote from, and it's okay to quote from it, there's some history there, it's interesting to see what's going on. But when you're appealing to the Talmud for support, look out, because you're appealing to the writings of your enemies.
Just to pick up on what he was saying, 1 Timothy 2:5 was written after Jesus had already ascended into heaven, and there's no ambiguity at all in that verse as to Paul's understanding of Jesus' ontological manifestation, which is that he was a human being, even at the right hand of God. And I've been thinking about this mediator thing as well, and a mediator, the qualification for a mediator is that he is not an offender. And so the offenses that mankind, humans, have offended God with their sin. And so the offense is largely in one direction, unless you or I or anyone in this room has ever been offended by God. It's kind of hard when he's perfect. So I think the offense is one way. It's mankind offending God with their sin. Well, Christ can be that mediator because he's the only one who hasn't offended God, and he can come alongside both parties and bring us to an understanding, just like if two of us get in a fight, or if we get in a fight and then Ken comes by, if he's not involved, then he can mediate. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. And also, Dustin wanted to point out that Acts 17:31, that at Mars Hill, Jesus also being ascended at that point in time, Paul commands them to repent because God has fixed a day in which he will judge the world through a man who he has furnished proof by raising him from the dead. So,
that's a good point. And that brings up another point of context, which is not just
Jonathan, I could remind you from your presentation last year that the mediator was neither God nor sinful man. Whether or not he was a man doesn't disqualify him. He wasn't sinful man. So he was a well-qualified mediator.
Well, actually, I had a little different take on it. Mediator being one that can relate to both sides, he was both, in a sense, he was the Son of God and he was the Son of Man. So, in a sense, he was both, so he could relate to both sides. Instead of being neither, I look at it as he was the Son of God and the Son of Man.
So much of what we're talking about hinges on the definition of the word God. And I don't know if we've ever properly defined the word. And that's why I have unilaterally decided to rename things, at least for myself. I can't speak for you all, or all y'all, or however that goes. We don't worship the one God, because that's not enough. That doesn't define it enough to the folks that have a different one God. The Muslims worship one God, Allah. We worship the one creator God. So I've just come to calling this the One Creator God Conference, because adding that one word makes all the difference in describing who it is that we are.
Is this going to be on your website, this paper?
Yes, as well as a lot of other things that have been collected from the last 5 years from many, many sources. I've been trying to not reinvent the wheel, but... Oh, yes, over the years, we've taken a list of the difficult scriptures, the ones that I didn't talk about today. They're on the website, and the answers, or an answer, or sometimes more than one, has been provided to all these difficult scriptures. You want to know about Genesis 19:24? Go look on the website. It's creatorgod.org, and you'll see one or two articles written by lots of people. Some of them I don't even know. I've never even met them, and they just submit articles, and they're wonderful. And Sean has submitted some things. And it's a list of at least an attempt at explaining these scriptures in the monotheistic context, the unitary monotheistic context. And I encourage everyone to send the information. This is the work of many people. I'm just coordinating it. Because every year we get together and we have these brilliant ideas. And then where do they go? Well, I've been collecting them. And I want to keep doing it. So that you can send your friends there. And at least they can get an idea of where to start.
Great.
Well, it's due to everybody contributing, and I'm so glad. Richard?
Just one thing, two. As far as mediator, maybe we could talk about it afterward. There's some aspects to this. I hate to be Copernicus, but there's some aspects to this that many of us who have been raised as we have been with our past have never even considered. But the other point is you mentioned that Jude mentions the dispute over the body of Moses. I would suggest that is in the Old Testament. And we could talk about that later, too, and we'll talk about where it is.
Oh, there is so much more to talk about. The discussions are endless. Oh, here comes Ken. It's almost over here. Thank you very much.
You can see his dad pacing around the back there. When is this verbose son of mine going to cut it? Well, I really appreciated that, Jonathan. And several of us do have websites, and I hope, you know, many of others of us develop them as well. The more literature out there, the more sites, the more places, the more information, the better. Certainly, we have an uphill job to counter some of the myths and misconceptions out there in the world around us. I should have mentioned about Jonathan that he is... besides an avid student of scriptures, you can tell. He's a businessman, owns a couple of furniture stores that he runs, and his wife, Christy, who's with him there, just completed her nursing training and is going to be going for a license to become an RN. And they've done all that with... last year he had four or five kids. It's probably a couple more now. How many do you have? Was that all? Well, they run fast. They look like more around here. We're just real happy to have the young people here with us. Have any of you read David Klinghoffer's book on Abraham discovering God? I forget the exact title of it. Brilliant writer. He writes a lot. He writes currently. He's an observant Jew, but he did a marvelous work on Abraham. And his mission and his evangelism in presenting the one God, monotheism, and how he went about it, and how he worked those caravan routes and put himself at these main intersections and used hospitality and other ways to share the news of the one God. And he did it in such a loving, hospitable context. And this was part of the way in which he... ministered. I certainly recommend the book to you.